I wonder if you've ever been on trial. Hopefully a few of us have had that experience of standing before a judge in a courtroom and having to give a defense of what we've done. But maybe many of us at different times have sat in a courtroom and listened to what's gone on, or maybe we've seen something on television. And there, as somebody has stood in the dock, the accused has been there, and the evidence has been presented by the prosecution. And then the defense come and they give their defense against what's been said. And long before the jury or the judge has ever made up their mind, those of us who are listening, those of us who are hearing, we ourselves, haven't we, have made up our minds about whether this person is guilty or innocent. And here in the Bible we have a great trial. And we, as those who are looking on, as it were, maybe have an opportunity to give our own verdict. Perhaps that's what we naturally do, as Jesus Christ here stands before the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council, and they give their prosecution, they give their evidence, but this time there's no defense, unlike probably any trial that you and I have ever witnessed. Even the fictional ones on TV, no defense is given. Jesus remains quiet for the most part of the trials. And yet then at the end, the verdict comes down. But what we often forget in the passage that we read together earlier from Mark chapter 14 and verses 53 to the end of that chapter is there's not just one trial that's going on here. Not just a trial of Jesus. In fact, in the passage that we read together, there are no less than three trials that are happening. There are three people, as it were, who are under judgment, who are under and hearing the prosecution against them. And what we're going to do, therefore, this morning as we look at this passage is we'll look at each of these trials in turn. And then as we conclude towards the end, we'll see just how relevant and how significant these trials are for ourselves. And not just relevant and significant, but actually life-changing if we were to take them seriously. So the first trial that I want to describe to you is not the trial of Jesus, but in fact the trial of Peter in verses 66 through to 72. Because what we find there is, just as Jesus is being formally tried by the Sanhedrin, by that Jewish ruling council, Peter, as it were, is himself on trial in an informal sense in the courtyard outside. You may remember that when Jesus was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, all of Jesus' disciples scattered. But Peter followed Jesus at a distance. And as he followed Jesus, we can read about this in verse 54, he went right into the courtyard of the high priest and sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire. Clearly, he wanted to be there to find out what was happening and what was going on. Maybe he thought that Jesus would do some miracle, perhaps, and escape and demonstrate his power. And maybe Peter wanted to be there when that happened. Maybe he didn't know what was going to happen at all and just wanted to find out. But whatever the reason, there Peter was in the courtyard, probably just yards away from where Jesus was being interrogated inside. But as Peter is standing there in the courtyard, three accusations, as it were, are made against Peter. You can see the first one in verse 67. A servant girl comes, a servant girl of the high priest. You also were with that Nazarene Jesus, she accuses him. So how is Peter going to respond? Is he going to respond and say, guilty? I was with Jesus? Or is he going to deny it and say, not guilty? Well, we see in verse 68, he denies it, not guilty, he says to the court, as it were, of this servant girl. I don't know or understand what you're talking about. And he obviously thinks, well, I'm in danger of this servant girl. I better get a bit further away from a place where she can accuse me. So he goes out into the entryway. And verse 69, she finds him there again. And this time there are other people standing around. And the servant girl just doesn't say quietly to Peter, he's made things worse for himself. She now says to the other people who are hanging around, she makes a public accusation. This fellow is one of them, she accuses. So how is Peter going to respond now? The evidence for the prosecution is mounting up, as it were. What does Peter say? Again, he declares, not guilty. Not guilty, he says. He denies it, verse 70. But a little while later, as those around are listening, they hear Peter's distinctive Galilean accent. Galilee, right there in the north, they had a distinctive accent. And they therefore say to Peter, you must be a follower of Jesus. You come from Galilee. Why else would you be here, is the implication. And Peter then, how is he going to respond? Now there are many people accusing him of being a follower of Jesus. Verse 71, not guilty, he says. And he even begins to call down curses and swear to them that he doesn't know the man that they're talking about. Not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, Peter says. But of course, Peter is guilty. He's guilty of the accusations that they level at him. In other circumstances, of course, Peter would be proud, perhaps, to be seen as a follower of Jesus. But in these last few hours, his world has been turned upside down. Jesus, in a very meek way, has been arrested. Peter tried to fight. Jesus told him to put his sword away. And Peter is guilty of following Jesus. But more than that, of course, he's guilty not just of following Jesus, but he's guilty now of denying to follow Jesus. He's added perjury, you might say, to his list of sins. And all this was prophesied by Jesus himself. Back in verse 29 of Mark chapter 14, Peter boldly had said to Jesus, even if all fall away, I will not. Truly I tell you, Jesus answered, today, yes, tonight, before the rooster crows twice, you will yourself disown me three times. But Peter insisted emphatically, even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. And all the others said the same. And now here is Peter, condemned not merely by a servant girl, condemned not merely by the crowd around, but condemned by his own words. And the rooster then crows the second time, verse 72. Peter suddenly remembers those words of Jesus which with the shock of everything that happened have left his mind. And he breaks down. And he weeps. Now it's easy perhaps to think badly of Peter, isn't it? He had a chance to stand for Jesus. And he blew it. He blew it altogether. But remember, as we read this story, that Peter is the best and the bravest of Jesus' disciples. That's how he's presented to us in the Gospels. That's how he appears in the book of Acts. That's how Jesus speaks of him himself. Do you remember? On this rock I will build my church. That's what Jesus said of Peter. At various times in the Gospel story, Jesus gathers three of his most trusted disciples together. And Peter is always in that number. He was there, for example, at the Transfiguration. He was there at the raising of the little girl, Tabitha, from the dead. He was there. In just a few weeks' time, it'll be Peter who will stand up in the midst of the disciples on the day of Pentecost and preach that great, powerful sermon in which thousands will be converted. It will be Peter who will be the great leader of the church in the opening chapters of the book of Acts. It's this Peter the best and the bravest of Jesus' disciples. It's this Peter who is on trial, as it were, in Mark chapter 14. It's this Peter who, despite his protestations of not guilty, is indeed guilty. So what do we make of this great trial of Peter? Well, I think what we're supposed to make of it is if the bravest and the best of Jesus' disciples claim to be not guilty, when in fact their guilt is obvious to see, if that's where the best and the bravest of Jesus' disciples go, then where do we go? What's the verdict for us? So that's the first trial. The trial of Peter, the first trial at least I wanted us to look at. But now a second trial that I want us to look at, and this is the one that perhaps we were thinking of all along. A trial now not of Peter, but the trial, of course, of Jesus himself in verses 53 through to 65. This is the trial that we all think of, perhaps, when we think of this part of the story. And you know, don't you, as you we read this story together, that as verse 55 tells us, that the chief priests and the whole of this Jewish council had come together. They were looking for evidence against Jesus so they could put him to death. It's not that they stumbled upon evidence. It's that they were actively looking for it. They were looking for any reason to do away with Jesus. They thought he was a blasphemer. They realized that he was usurping what they felt was their authority and their power. They realized that he was popular in a way that they never were, that he spoke with authority in a way that they never could, and they wanted rid of him. So what did they do? Well, they were looking for evidence, but as verse 55 says, they didn't find any. There was no evidence about Jesus Christ. Of course there wasn't. Because there was never a man like Jesus, was there? There was never a man who lived like this. There was never a man for whom it could be said he did nothing wrong. But that's what was said of Jesus Christ. He was innocent in every way. It's not just that they wouldn't have been able to find a charge that would stick, that would be able to put him to death. No charge would have stuck against Jesus Christ. As Pilate will say later on, he's done nothing wrong. So what do they do? Well, they resort, verse 56, to false witnesses giving false testimonies. But even as they try and do that, there's no way that the witnesses can get their testimonies to agree. They come up in the end with this false statement in verse 58 that they heard Jesus say, I will destroy this temple made with human hands, and in 3 days we'll build another not made with hands. Well, of course, if they could have got that charge to stick, if that was true, then perhaps that would be a reason for condemning Jesus to death. It would be a great act of treachery, a great act of violence to bring this great temple crashing down. Perhaps today we would call it an act of terrorism. If this were true, then maybe this would be the charge that they could bring against him. But of course it wasn't true. What Jesus actually says, as we read in John's Gospel, was not that he will destroy the temple and raise it again, but when this temple is destroyed, I will raise it again in 3 days. Jesus was not saying he will destroy the temple, he was saying that he will raise the temple. But it couldn't stick because their testimonies did not agree. So now there's this great frustration, it seems, in the high priest, verse 60. And he then asks Jesus, well, how are you going to answer? And maybe he's hoping that Jesus will be trapped by his own words. The testimonies can't agree. But if he can get Jesus to admit that this is what he will say, then that perhaps they'll be able to condemn him. Because what they want through and through is they want to have a charge that they can bring against Jesus that they can then present before Pontius Pilate and have Jesus crucified. They want to be able to put the blame, as it were, on the Roman authorities. They want to be able to say he was condemned as a criminal. They want all of his followers to see just what a dangerous man this was. They don't want the repercussions for themselves. So they're trying to build a case that they can take to Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor. So what does the high priest ask? Well, you can see in verse 61, at the end of that verse, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" Now, as we read that question perhaps today, we think of it in very theological terms. But as that question was asked by the high priest in the first century, it wasn't asked in theological terms. Because those little phrases, the Messiah and the Son of the Blessed One, they did have theological meaning, certainly, but they had greater political meaning. This is a political question against Jesus in order that he might condemn himself in a way that can be taken to Pontius Pilate. The Messiah, first of all, that's the first accusation that is made against Jesus. This really is what he is on trial for. Are you the Messiah? Who's the Messiah? Well, the Messiah is there in the Old Testament, the promised one of God. Throughout the Old Testament period, there was one who would come, God had said, and described in different ways in different sections, in different parts of the Bible, sometimes called a great prophet who would come, sometimes called a great king who would come, sometimes called a servant who would come, sometimes it was God himself who would come. And sometimes this word used, Messiah, the anointed one will come. It's a kingly description. In the Old Testament, it was kings who were anointed. And what the people in the first century were expecting, the great many of them in the first century were expecting that God would send this person to this world who would become the king of the nation, who would drive out the enemies. And of course, that meant the Romans, the people that Pontius Pilate represented. So if Jesus is claiming to be the Messiah, then absolutely he's a threat to the Romans, and the Romans should do away with him. It's a political question, first of all. And even the next phrase, are you the Son of the Blessed One? In other words, are you the Son of God? Well, Jesus was the Son of God in a great theological and ontological sense that the chief priests never understood. He was, of course, that. But that's not what they mean. That category never existed for them. There's no way they could even conceive of a human being being the Son of God in a divine sense as we understand it now. No, that's not what they meant. They meant it again in this kingly sense. Because in the Old Testament, the kings of Israel are described sometimes as sons of God. What does that mean? Well, it means as they're gods, as it were, princes or representatives here on earth. They're the ones who rule for God here. The ones who God cares for in a special way. And they are sons of the Blessed One. That's what's the high priest was asking. So how does Jesus respond? Peter has already faced his accusations. And each time Peter faced his accusations, he said that he was not guilty. So what is Jesus going to say here as he's this great accusation? You see, if the accusation that was leveled against Peter might have been one that he was risking his life, the accusation that's leveled against Jesus is one that's not just risking his life. But if Jesus pleads guilty to this, his life will be forfeit. There's no question about it. And Jesus says, paraphrasing of course, "Guilty as charged. I am," he says. And even as he says those two little words, "I am," he is invoking the name of God for himself. God, of course, describes himself as I am, as he reveals himself to Moses at the burning bush. But Jesus goes further. It's as if he's saying to the high priest, well, you don't know the half of it. Yes, I am the Messiah. Yes, I am the Son of the Blessed One. But you don't understand what the Messiah is. You don't understand what the Son of the Blessed One is. I'm not answering this question in the political way that you're asking it. I'm answering in this great theological sense. Listen to this, Jesus is saying. You will see the Son of Man. That's how he describes himself. But it's also a description given in Daniel chapter 7. We'll look at that in a moment. Sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. So as Jesus describes himself, he brings these two great pictures from the Old Testament together, Daniel 7:13 and Psalm 110 and verse 1. And as he does that, he brings these two great pictures of a divine figure who's coming to earth. Jesus is saying effectively, you think the Messiah is political. You think the Son of the Blessed One is political? Not at all. No, I am more than you ever imagine. I am God himself come down to earth. And the high priest now understands. He understands that Jesus isn't just claiming something political. He understands the significance of what Jesus says, which is why verse 63, he tears his clothes. He says, we need no more witnesses. He describes what Jesus says as blasphemy, and they condemn him as worthy of death. They're no longer now simply seeking evidence to present to Pilate. They themselves have condemned him. And they begin to spit and strike him with their fists and beat him. They have found him guilty. And what do we learn? Well, at this moment, just very simply, don't we see here Jesus doing the exact opposite of what Peter has just done? So Peter's been faced with these charges. Not guilty, says Peter. Not guilty, not guilty. And yet he's guilty all the way through. Jesus, faced with much more serious charges, and effectively says, guilty as charged. And Jesus therefore maintains his innocence, whereas Peter condemns himself. Two trials, Peter and Jesus. But I said there were three trials in this passage. And you may be scratching your head now and thinking, well, where's the third trial? We've looked at all the verses now, and we've only seen two trials. Where's the third one? Well, it comes in the very same verses we've just been looking at, verses 53 through to 65. We've seen a trial of Peter. We've seen a trial of Jesus. But actually, the ones who are really on trial in this whole passage is not Peter and not Jesus, but it's the chief priests and the elders and the teachers of the law. It's they really who are on trial. Because as Jesus describes himself as the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven, he's not just talking about himself as a divine figure. He's not just saying, you need to understand, I'm not just a man, but I'm also God. He's not just saying, you think I was born in Bethlehem, but no, I existed in heaven before that. I'm not just saying that, Jesus is speaking here. Because that picture from Psalm 110 of the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One is a picture of what? It's a picture of power. It's a picture of authority. It's a picture of judgment. Look at the end of Psalm 110. When you get home, you'll see it very clearly there that this one will judge the nations. You look at Daniel chapter 7 and the prophecy that is given of the one who is coming on the clouds of heaven. Don't think here merely of clouds, of being the bringers of rain. No, in these Old Testament pictures, clouds represent something greater. They represent the glory, the Shekinah glory of God himself. You remember the pillar of cloud that took the Israelites through the desert. You may remember at different parts of the Old Testament, clouds that would cover, as it were, God's presence. Clouds that would descend on the tabernacle or the temple to show that God is there. And that's what these clouds represent. And again, it's a picture of power, a picture of authority, and a picture too of judgment. So here's what Jesus is saying to the chief priests and the elders and the whole of the Sanhedrin. He's saying something like this. You think, he's saying, that you here today are judging me. But that's not what's going on. Because I am God himself, stepped down from heaven. And I am the judge in this room, not you. And it's not Jesus who is condemned. In a sense, it's not even Peter who's condemned, not primarily. It's the chief priests who are condemned. It's they, those who would judge Jesus, who are condemned. And actually, that means, therefore, this picture that we've seen on Jesus, seen of Jesus, that actually there's not even just three trials that are here in this passage, but there's a fourth trial too. A fourth trial that's implicit rather than explicit. We've seen that Peter's on trial. And he said, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty. Whereas in fact he was guilty, guilty, guilty. We've seen the high priests and the others on trial. They didn't even realize that they were on trial. They, of course, thought they were innocent, thought that they were better than other men. But Jesus is effectively pronouncing them guilty, guilty, guilty. And Jesus, in presenting himself as a judge, presents himself not just as a judge of the high priests and all the chief priests, but he presents himself as a judge of the world. So this fourth trial then, Peter's not on trial, chief priests are not on trial, but we are on trial. It's we who stand in the dock. It's we who face the Messiah. We who face the Son of the Blessed One. We who face the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. And at our very best, at our very best, we are Peter, aren't we? At our very best, we are a brave but flawed disciple and follower of Jesus who fails. At our very best, we're Peter. And like Peter, we stand condemned. And at our worst, we are like the high priests and the chief priests and the elders and the teachers of the law, who, although we stand in the dock, we pronounce judgment on God. I've met many people over the years who have become interested in Christianity, who have talked to me about the gospel, who have listened as I've shared something of the gospel message. And at the end of our conversation or discussion or presentation or sermon or whatever it may be, do you know what those people have done? Very many of them, I might even say most of them. They've stood as judges against God. And they've weighed up what God offers. They've weighed up what they've heard about God. And very many of them have found God wanting. They've stood in judgment against God. They've effectively said something like this, well, I don't want a God who demands my full obedience and allegiance. And this God that I've seen and this God that I think of doesn't deserve that of me. They may say something like this, this is a God after all who allows suffering in this world. I don't want to worship a God like that. And they stand in judgment against him. But that mistake that is made by many of those who are not Christians is a mistake that Christians can make too sometimes. Circumstances and situations happen in our lives, and things don't go according to our plan. And we sit in judgment against God. And we say something like, God, how could you let this happen? To me, one of your followers, one of your children, you've got this wrong, God, we might say. And we stand in judgment against the one who made us. The pot, condemning the potter. But we ourselves stand condemned, not just by what the Bible says against us, but like Peter, we stand condemned by our own words, don't we? It's not just that we fail to meet God's standard, but every single one of us here this morning has failed to meet our own standards, haven't we? Every one of us at different times has said something like, I will never do that. We've judged other people for things far less than we've done ourselves. And we stand condemned by our own words as well as by our own actions. So why is all this going on in the Bible? Why did God the Father allow Jesus to stand on trial in this way, to be mocked, to be despised, to be condemned despite his innocence? Why did all this happen? Well, we could argue that in a sense what's going on here through these chapters and into chapter 15 of Mark's Gospel is that Jesus is being put on trial, as it were, not simply by the chief priests, but he's put on trial by his heavenly Father. And as Jesus in the chapter to come will be nailed to that cross, it will be God, as it were, God the Father, who will be pronouncing the curses that Peter called down from heaven. You see, do you remember that in verse 71? Peter began to call down curses. Now, on whom did those curses fall? Not on Peter. Not on Peter, the guilty one. But those curses fell on Jesus, the innocent one. And God, the Heavenly Father, rained down, as it were, curses on his own Son, Jesus, as Jesus stood condemned in Peter's place. And in our place too. God was putting Jesus Christ on trial. But here's the strange thing about Jesus standing before his Father. Because as Jesus stood before his Father, two things happened. The first thing that happened is that punishment came. The punishment that the guilty one deserves. That's the first thing that happened. Not the nails, not the crown of thorns, not the spear in the side, not the insults and the mocking, not the beatings, not the crucifixion, not that. But the great wrath of God poured out on Jesus as if he was the guilty one. That came first. And then after the punishment, what happened? After the punishment was the great vindication. Because after the punishment, as Jesus then was laid in that cold tomb dead, 3 days later, he rose again. And as he rose again, what was God the Father doing? He was vindicating his Son. He was declaring his Son to be righteous. He was declaring that all the things that Jesus claimed of himself, that he was the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One, the Son of Man, sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One, were true. That Jesus Christ really is the judge of all the world. And he was vindicated, declared righteous by God. And his life had proved it. Now through his resurrection, his heavenly Father demonstrates it. So for Peter then, the curses he called down on himself fell on Jesus Christ. The punishment that he deserved fell on God's only Son. The vindication that Jesus Christ won was given to Peter. So that by the end of the gospel accounts, Peter is restored. Peter is forgiven. And as we've already touched on right at the very beginning, he becomes a great leader, the church, Jerusalem. So what of us then? Well, we're maybe not quite so foolish as Peter. But we're probably not as brave as Peter either. And in the quietness of our own hearts, we stand condemned by our own words. But Peter, you see, realized his weakness, and realized his failings, and realized his sin, and he broke down and wept. He repented, in other words. And Jesus took him through this slow process of restoration, and he was restored. And that's what Jesus offers today. Through his crucifixion, through the wrath of God being poured out on him, the curses that we deserve can fall on him if we put our trust in the Son of God who died in our place. And I know for many of us this morning, this is not something that we need to do, but it's something also that we have done. Our trust is in Jesus Christ. And because our trust is in Jesus Christ, he then is this great shelter and protector, is he not? This one who stands, rescues us, saves us from the wrath of God. There will come a day where you and I will face the judgment seat of Christ. Come a day where you and I deserve to hear those words, guilty. And on that day, the Son of Man, who is sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One, the one who has come on the clouds of heaven, will stand and say, I took that guilt. I took that shame. I took that punishment. And this one, this brother of mine, this sister of mine, is therefore free. It's what we celebrate and remember every time we meet around the Lord's table. It's what we should celebrate and remember every moment of our lives, that we, the guilty ones, go free.